America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin. Welcome back to America Trends. Now, this is going to be fun. Do you live and die whether the Yankees or the Red Sox win every night? Or pick any team in any town? Do you wear the colors and the uniforms of your sports heroes? Do people tell you it's a waste of time spending beautiful Sundays in the fall on the couch, rooting for a touchdown or a tackle? Recent studies suggest that being a big sports fan may be beneficial to your health. I'm not kidding. So get out your banners and caps and take a listen so you can have bragging rights the next time someone wants to pull you off the couch or your recliner as you're fixated to it. Revisiting fandom today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends, another Larry, Larry Olmsted. And he's a remarkable writer on many different subjects and admits in this book about fans that he's not the biggest sports fan in the world, though he's got an inspiration in the book saying, "My father was not a sports fan, but when I was growing up, he took my brother and me to baseball games at Shea Stadium. I never saw him turn on a game on television or read the sports section. And after he died, I wondered why he'd spent so much time at the ballpark." And after looking at this issue of fans, how watching sports makes us happier, healthier, and more understanding, what greater understanding did you come to as to why your father wanted to bond with you in that way?
Well, it's just a classic family time, quality time thing to do, and has been, you know, for sort of the history of sports in America, if not, you know, pre-America. And what in the 4 years or so that I was working on this book, I traveled the world and I talked to hundreds of fans in different cultures. And that seems to be like the one shared memory all sports fans have is, oh, yeah, the first game I ever saw with my dad or my grandparents or my sibling, you know, some sort of multi-generational family memory that bonds us over sports in a way we can't really, you know, maybe bond over TV shows or a pop culture or other forms of entertainment.
Well, I think you're right. I remember 1962 watching on the couch with my father, who was a New York Giants fan, when they moved to San Francisco in the dark of night. He still stayed a San Francisco Giant fan, and we saw them lose Game 7 to the New York Yankees, and that is one of those experiences I can't forget. And then my son and I have gone to many Knicks game, so I know what it's like to be a fan who suffers, but we have bonded over the Knicks for so many years, and it really is a very special moment just sharing that and knowing, though, that I'm passing on that legacy, Larry, to my son, so he's got many more decades than I in terms of suffering as a Knicks fan.
Right, and it's not just you and your son. You're both part of, you know, a community, an ongoing community of Knicks fans. And, you know, one of the things, you know, in sports, doesn't really matter what sport it is, you know, fans around the world have this mantra, wait until next year, right? There's always this hope. And that points to the fact that, you know, sports teams are basically infinite. You know, they're corporations, and the Yankees were playing 100 years ago, and they'll presumably be playing 100 years from now. But, you know, there's not much else that we kind of, you know, follow in our life that has that sense of permanence.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I've got to tell you, you know, in another life, I was involved in television, and I brought UConn women's basketball to television back in 1994. And what that has meant to the state of Connecticut, and you understand this, Larry, but I see obituaries to this day, and in it, in the first or second paragraph, will be a woman often, or a man, saying, that they loved watching UConn women's basketball, and they weren't sports fans at all.
Yeah, and I mean, UConn really, you know, in a way, put women's collegiate basketball on the big stage. One of my neighbors here in Vermont, actually, their son works for the UConn women's team. It's funny that, you mentioned the obituaries, because it wasn't until I wrote this book that I learned that, you know, in addition to, you know, you could go into the UConn bookstore and they'll have these NCAA logo, you know, cups and hats and jerseys with holograms on them, vouching for their authenticity. But until I researched this book, I didn't realize that the NCAA also licensed coffins, you know, especially if you're like an Alabama Roll Tide fan. A lot of them are buried in their team gear, literally. So that shows the depth of the fandom.
Oh, absolutely. And how healthy is that? I mean, you point to a lot of experiments that exhibit how sports fans maintain better cognition, language skills. And I think that really, you know, kind of flies in the face of what we often think, which is that it's mindless, vacuous, and oftentimes just a consumptive activity with no value.
Yeah, I mean, I actually kind of came to the subject with the thought that that would probably be the case. I was not, you know, pro-fan. I just thought this would be an interesting thing to look at. But as soon as I dove into the research, I realized, you know, it's overwhelmingly beneficial. You know, it's not a panacea. There's, you know, certainly not everything about sports and sports fandom is great. But the good outweighs the bad. And when it comes to mental health, I mean, most of the fandom, real concrete benefits of fandom revolve around happiness. But the things you talked about, actual, you know, brain health, are important, especially as we age. And I think it's very similar to people who do Sudoku every day or a crossword puzzle, or, you know, they've demonstrated that keeping your intellect engaged is good for your cognitive skills as you age. And sports is a way to do that. And if anything, it's become more of a way to do that. Because when I went with my dad to Shea Stadium, you know, in the 70s, he taught me how to score in the program. But, you know, all we really cared about were a few stats, RBI, ERA. And now we've got these sabermetrics and Moneyball. And to be an informed sports fan and to play fantasy sports, especially, which I know something like 60 million people in North America do, you know, you have to not only follow these stats, but in other sports, football, basketball, the offenses, the defenses, the formations, all of this stuff has gotten much more complex. And sports fans in America have this, you know, love of calling in on Monday to talk radio and second-guessing what the football team did on Sunday. And in order to do that competently, you have to have a pretty high level of understanding of the strategy of the game. And I think, you know, you can enjoy sports without knowing much about them in a lot of cases, but to be a serious football or baseball or basketball fan it's really a more of an intellectual pursuit than people think.
Well, particularly what you mentioned, and those were two things that I really wanted to delve a bit into. First of all, some people love one team. I mentioned UConn women, and some people only love UConn women and they don't care about the rest of basketball. There are people who just love a team within a league context, and others, as you say, lately involved in fantasy football. What about that phenomenon? Because that's not team-based. It's not wearing somebody's jersey. It's not a community that you can relate to in your own town. Explain how that is different in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two big areas in which fantasy football or fantasy sports, football is the most popular, but all fantasy sports have a real impact. One is that it's sort of become a social media platform of its own. It's like its own version of Facebook, in that people who play keep in touch with their colleagues via the internet. And people I talk to that play fantasy sports have multiple leagues, and they're usually built around a theme of friendship. So people they went to college with, they'll play in a league with, people they used to work with at their old job. One woman I spoke to who had extensive health problems was in a league with the people at the physical therapy place where she had been treated for years. So, you know, it's a way of keeping in touch, and especially in the pandemic, that was really important to people. That's one level. But the bigger level for sports fans is that the fantasy sports has kind of started to break down the tribal barriers where, you know, I love the Yankees, so I have to hate the Red Sox. You know, now if you want to be even a modicum successful at fantasy sports, you have to have players from, you know, those hated other teams. And that in turn makes you, you know, appreciate them more. And what I found, I mean, I talked to a really ardent fantasy player who's an avid Washington Redskins, or what used to be, I guess, Washington football team now, fan. And he told me it took him 4 or 5 years before he could bring himself to draft anyone from the Cowboys. But he did, because he wanted to win. What that does, I think, is it makes people appreciate the game more of football or baseball rather than just their team.
What has sports talk radio done? One of the most successful formats in radio over the last 30 or 40 years. And then ESPN. What has both of those phenomena from a media standpoint meant?
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember when ESPN launched and people were like, oh, nobody will ever watch that much sports. And now there's, you know, ESPN2 and ESPN this and Fox Sportsnet and all of these New England Sports Network and all of these other channels. And I think what it's done, I mean, right now it's having a little bit of a more mainstream effect as the big leagues, like, you know, the NFL starts to broadcast games on all these different stations and TNT, and where they used to, you know, kind of stick to the networks. But really what I think the ESPNs of the world have done is made it possible to watch more different sports. Certainly, you know, I have friends who are into cycling who watch, like, Tour de France stuff, which used to be really hard to get on TV. European soccer has benefited a lot from exposure on more networks in the United States. I think it's just, to me, you know, I get asked a lot, like, oh, you know, I'm not a fan, you know, and I say, well, you know, there's probably a sport out there that maybe you haven't watched. You don't like football, you don't like baseball, you know, there's so many sports. Maybe, you know, I like American Ninja Warrior, I talk about that in the book, but maybe for you it's, you know, curling. But now you can find all of these things on TV that you didn't used to be able to. Sports radio is a little bit different, and sports radio sometimes gets a knock for having kind of a high rate of vitriol and you know, people angry. But I think it's very similar to social media, right? Like, there's a phenomenon we well know now, where, you know, people act on Twitter and such in a different way than they would in person. You know, they have this sort of anonymity and platform and voice. So I think sports radio lets people call in and be angry, but that doesn't mean that everybody, you know, who watches sports is angry. I think it's, you know, more of just an outlet. And what sports radio does is it gives those people who love sports something to listen to constantly in the car. And also, you know, everything nowadays, it doesn't matter whether it's sports or politics or entertainment, is labeled breaking news, even when it's not. You know, I see that breaking news scroll across the screen, and then it's like somebody joined the cast of some sitcom. You know, to me, that's not breaking news. But it's the same with sports. You know, they get their quote-unquote breaking news faster with sports radio.
And by the way, the callers, having done talk radio, represent less than 1% of the people who are actually listening, and maybe less hyperbolic about the whole thing. Let me ask you about this period during the pandemic and what you have seen, because we've seen it fanless. And then, of course, we remember what a stadium or an arena looked like when it was fan-filled. I'm wondering what you think that impact is on the players, what it is on the entire environment. We know it's got financial implications galore, but what do you think you've seen during the pandemic as fans have been excluded from many events live?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because I had basically finished the book just before the pandemic began, but we weren't planning on running it right away anyway because of the election and everything in the news cycle. And then the pandemic came, so it kind of gave me a chance to reassess. And in a lot of ways, the pandemic was a living laboratory for a lot of the ideas in the book. The empty stadiums, I mean, short term, when sports went away, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, worldwide, basically every sport was canceled, put on hiatus. Fans were really jonesing for something to watch. There was a void that needed to be filled. And when it came back, the fans didn't really care how it came back. Bubbles, empty stadiums, they just wanted to watch sports. Short term, you know, empty stadiums are better than no stadiums for the fans. For the players, it was worse. The players, you know, in virtually no sport have ever played not in front of an audience. And you saw it in everything from basketball to golf, where, you know, they would make the putt or hit the three-pointer and kind of turn to the stands and pump their fist and then realize there was nobody there seeing them. And when even a few fans, I saw, you know, when the Dallas Mavericks had the first game with any fans just a couple, maybe a month ago, they had like 1,200 medical people and first-line responders that had been vaccinated in a stadium that holds 20-some-odd thousand people. So still, you know, 5% full, but the players were saying what a difference it made to finally have somebody in the stands. So I think, you know, during the pandemic, at least, it was worse for the players than the fans. But long-term, it would not be sustainable. A big part of fandom, a bigger part of the benefit we get is tied up in having people at the games than people realize. That's what creates the sense of community. That's why fans sitting on their couch at home feel like they're part of the action, even if they're alone, because they see all those people in the stands. And long-term, empty stadiums would be detrimental to our experience.
Larry, in your book, you talk about the pressure from fans encouraging safety changes in sports, exemplified by the drop in NFL viewership due to the research on concussions back in 2016. And I want to admit that I used to watch some football, but I got so discouraged. I did a podcast about some of these practices and some of the negligence as it relates to the health of the players, and I just kind of gave that up. I still love other sports. But the question is, what is the impact of the fan on the conduct of a sport? I went to a lecture with Ralph Nader. I know that for a long time he was trying to set up a fans union. And one of the issues at this lecture they were talking about was fan safety at a baseball game such that they would not get hurt by foul ball.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fans have the potential to have enormous power and leverage over leagues and teams because it's, you know, where the money is, both advertising at home and tickets at the stadium and concessions. And I use the concussion example because it's one of the most concrete where, you know, the NFL and players knew that there was an issue for a long time, but it was sort of a perfect storm of this multi-billion dollar lawsuit and the Will Smith movie Concussion kind of coming to the news at the same time. A lot of sports writers started writing op-eds, just like you said, that they could no longer, you know, morally tolerate watching football. And then ratings started to go down, and NFL football is the most watched sport in America. So, you know, that immediately got the ball moving within the NFL, whereas all the player complaints and other medical evidence had not. So that, you know, shows me that when the fans, you know, I don't think it was a concerted, fans didn't bang together in a union and say, let's start watching football. It, you know, was organic. But if my point was that the same thing could be applied to, you know, domestic violence and other, you know, incidents where athletes commit crimes and then come back to work in a way that typically wouldn't be tolerated in other jobs. You know, I'm not in any way anti-athlete. I just think, you know, there, in any large pool of people, there's a few bad apples, and that, you know, that's a way to make the sports less tolerant of that. I don't know as whether there'd be a lot of traction for an actual fan union, but even the foul ball issue, you know, once, unfortunately, bad things have to happen and bad press has to happen, but a few people got hit and they started putting up more netting and these things. So I think, you know, the leagues are not quick. They're not proactive, but they can be responsive to fan ire.
This whole issue of social action and athletes is a very interesting one because that's where the fan reacts to what it is that the player is doing above and beyond when they are getting into issues like domestic violence, like the concussion issue, like racial equity. And then you see certain fans supporting them, others saying, no, we don't want to listen to you about these issues. We want to see you dribble the ball or hit a home run.
There has been for a long time this subcurrent within an element of fans and the media of, you know, politics and sports shouldn't mix, just play the game or, you know, just shut up and dribble, which, you know, definitely to me has undertones of racism in it. But it doesn't make any sense because politics and sport have always been intertwined from both sides. There have always been activist athletes going back to, you know, Muhammad Ali and John Carlos and Tommy Smith at the 1968 Mexico City Olympic Games. The difference there being that they had to make their statements and then hope that a media that was generally unfriendly to them would get their message to the people, whereas athletes today can take their message directly to their fans, millions and millions of fans, in their exact same words. Social media has really empowered the activist athlete. But at the same time, politics has used sports, and Joe Lewis was brought to the White House, and, you know, Joe, your muscles have to stop the Nazis, and politicians, your White House visits have surrounded themselves with athletes, traditionally thrown out opening game balls, gone to games. You know, they use sports, so it seems one-sided. And if you look at our last two U.S. presidents, pre-Biden, obviously very different people, both ostensibly sports fans, And no one in the media would ever go to them and say, you can't be a sports fan because you're a politician and those shouldn't mix. So it's sort of one-way street to me. I think, you know, it's America and, you know, we have the freedom to do things, and that includes athletes.
Now, in the book, you don't give sports a pass when it comes to its historical inheritance of problems. We saw that just recently in the NCAA basketball tournament, the inequities as to the weight room for the women versus the men. How do you think sports does in terms of dealing with the various inequities as opposed to the larger society? Is it ahead of it? Is it right where the society is, or is it behind?
I think it's definitely ahead of it. And, you know, and I devote, you know, a good chunk of chapters to the progression from, you know, civil rights, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, up to the current kind of social justice movement. And, you know, a great example is Title IX, right? I went to this big sports and society conference that actually is put on by the Vatican, and people are surprised that, you know, the Vatican and the UN and all these global organizations regularly use sport as sort of a peace and social progress tool. You know, there were a number of really high-powered women CEOs there who talked about how it was Title IX that really broke that glass ceiling in a way that then led to politics and governors and more Congress people and more CEOs being women because of sports. And I think sports was ahead of that. And, you know, certainly, you know, civil rights, Jackie Robinson was ahead of the Civil Rights Act. And so I think sports has played a steady beneficial role in the progress, but it's a kind of two steps forward, one step back thing. You know, to say that, you know, we've reached any kind of, you know, modicum of social perfection in this country would be kind of ridiculous at this time in light of what's going on right now, but it's sports has played a role in making it better than it was.
You do talk about sports in relation to tribalism that we're now seeing politically. And I read where you once said that you don't see MAGA, for example, that tribal movement, and sports fandom metastasizing. To the contrary, you believe that sports can inoculate society against the risks of such extremism, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I find I call sports, you know, this universal language. And my experience, I mean, first of all, any fan base of any major sports team is diverse. It includes people of every political persuasion, race, sex, age, income level. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, being a member of a fan community is such an easy way to have a sense of belonging, because fan communities are totally accepting and democratic, and you don't have to go through any kind of application process to become a fan of your team. You know, you put on a jersey and walk down an aisle in a supermarket and see somebody else in a hat, and they're going to look at you and make eye contact and give you the, you know, NHL executive told me they call the head nod, and like, you and I are connected even though we don't know each other and we're completely different people. So sports fandom is accepting in that way. But at the individual level, you know, I've traveled the world, and I spend a lot of time in airport bars, and you go in, there's a flat screen above the TV, and pretty much any airport bar in the world with something on, it might be baseball, it might be cricket, you know, it doesn't, snooker, it doesn't really matter. You sit down there, you look up at that screen, you turn to the person next to you, and you've got a new friend. And it doesn't, again, doesn't matter race, religion, age, political, you know, perspectives. And even if you, you know, come upon a fan of your sport and you have a disagreement where, you know, you're a Giants fan and they're a Cowboys fan, you know, it's a friendly thing. You're not going to, like, get into a fight in the airport bar over that. It's not like politics.
Well, let me ask, when does it turn from something really healthy and something that stimulates you and brings you together with people who may on other issues be very different than you, and drift over into something more dark and all-consuming? I say that only because we know that it's a derivative fan of fanatic. When do you know that you're a little beyond the pale when it comes to this? You know, I see some of these ads during Knicks games or promos, and people have shrines or homes. I mean, I'm a devoted fan, but I don't have that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. It's when it becomes excessive to the point where it has an impact, a negative impact on your life. And the thing that interests me a lot, and you know, obviously I've been thinking about this subject for a long time, is if you tell people, like, you know, that your hobby is, you know, building model railroads or doing crossword puzzles or knitting, nobody ever says, like, wow, doesn't that take a lot of time? Is that a waste of time? But if you say sports, people think it does somehow. It's when you know, you're so entrenched in watching everything that it eats into other parts of your life, especially, you know, the fabric of your family. You know, if you're ignoring your family because you're watching sports, that's not a good thing. But, you know, fortunately, that's not most sports fans. The bigger problem I see is financial. When, you know, people are spending money they can't afford to be sports fans. And that typically doesn't happen through the watching, because even if you get like NFL Pass on DirecTV or whatever, most sports on TV is a pretty affordable thing. But it's when, you know, the season tickets, you have to hang on to them, or your Giants seat license, whatever they call it now, you have to pay a fee for tickets. And then the gear, you know, you certainly don't need to buy NFL team jersey to be an NFL fan, but if you do, it's a lot of money. You know, when you know, you go to Yankee Stadium and a light beer is $14 or whatever. You know, so it's easy. You know, to me, you know, my wife is from the Bronx, so going to Yankee Stadium once a year is like a fun event, like going to the theater. But I couldn't possibly afford to be a season ticket holder. And if you're like, you know, struggling to make ends meet and trying to do that, then I think that's a dangerous road.
What about gambling as part of it? I mean, the average sports fan, let's assume, watches it because they get all the benefit that you're talking about. But there are many who watch sports basically as a financial concern. You know, how does that trip over from fandom to gambling on sports as you've seen it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I have not done a lot of research on the gambling side because, you know, legal widespread sports gambling is a very new phenomenon. You know, I mean, there's always been bookies and people have always bet on sports, but there's not a lot of data on that because it's sort of off the books. Until very recently, you had to go to Las Vegas to bet on sports legally. That has changed dramatically. It's changed very recently. But I also don't think, I don't agree that a lot of people watch sports because of their financial interest. I think a lot of people gamble. I mean, look, there's casinos I saw some stat, there's a casino within a two-hour drive of the vast majority of the American population, most of which don't have sports books. So it's just a matter of what you're going to gamble on. People want to gamble. Their state lotteries is gambling, but like, you know, people who like sports would be more inclined to bet on sports. I think, you know, it's whatever you gamble on, the issue is, do you have a problem? If you're gambling money, can't afford to lose, gambling too much, you know, obviously gambling is like drinking, fine for a lot of people, not fine for other people. I don't, you know, encourage gambling in any way, but, you know, I don't think it's a problem with sports.
What about the weight gain? A lot of people, when we see the commercials on television, when we see sports fans gathered on a Sunday, it's often around Doritos, and I know you've written about real food, fake food. It's around a lot of fake food, let's put it that way, Larry. And yet, you tell us that at times, depending upon the sport, like the Olympics or even cycling, it translates into more activity, that more people actually want to participate rather than simply watch.
I do talk about researching that the stereotype of the sports fan as portrayed in movies, TV, and even commercials. And it is that it's a stereotype that really isn't true, that it's overwhelmingly male, overwhelmingly overweight, and overwhelmingly eating to excess. I've clearly, like, you know, we typically, when it's not a pandemic, would either host or go to a Super Bowl party every year, and then we would have wings and Doritos. But when I watch football on any other Sunday, you know, home alone with my wife, we don't put out a big spread of junk food in front of us. But, yeah, so sports fans are more active than non-fans. That's, you know, a fact. It's, you know, been demonstrated, but it's a little murky because it's a chicken and an egg question, right? Some people are sports fans because they played sports already. You know, maybe they played whatever it was, Little League, youth soccer, got them encouraged in sports. So it's not that watching sports necessarily makes you more active. It's just that fans are more active. So I looked into the question of, you know, could simply watching spectator sports, you know, transform us into more active, fitter people? And I found, you know, many examples of that through what called the participation effect, where you're otherwise sedentary and you view something that turns you from a couch potato into a participant. And there's a lot of examples, but the most regular, which is about to come up, is the Olympics. Every 2 years, watching the Olympics fuels a spike in gym memberships and what's called general fitness interest, which is interesting because, you know, like I like watching the NFL. You mentioned concussions, right? I like watching the NFL, but I've never watched a game and said, I'm going to go buy a helmet and go out in the street and have somebody hit me. That just doesn't really happen. But when people watch the Olympics and they see a lot of sports that they haven't seen that revolve around sort of individual athleticism and training, track and field, rowing, cycling, triathlon. And the athletes, in a way, even though they're elite, are more relatable because they're college students, they're people who are training hard, who are not multimillionaires, who are never going to be on a Nike commercial, who are just, you know, they work out and they do their thing and they went to the Olympics. And that encourages people to sort of, like, it's like a New Year's resolution. I'm going to get in shape. And I, you know, today in society, that's a really good thing. And there's other examples, but I like the Olympics because it now happens every 2 years. It used to be every 4 years, and it's a kind of a boon for the viewers.
How much do you think athletes and the ownership of teams or those who run programs, say at university level, think about the fan experience? I know when I do go to games, there's a lot more going on than simply what's going on the diamond or on the field or in the arena. There's all kinds of entertainment. So how much is the fan experience a big part of the calculation that, again, teamership or management or NCAA really factor in to their considerations?
You know, I think a lot of thought goes into it, but maybe not for the right reasons. So, you know, I think this fan experience is viewed as a commercial product, the same way a guest experience might be viewed by a hotel chain, not to maybe actually, you know, make the person's life richer, but to sell more tickets and sell more stuff and make, you know, so I think it's more outside of the stadium, there's more of a disconnect between leagues and teams and their fan bases. You know, certainly when you see some of these characters, you know, kind of super fans who are at every game doing something, throwing T-shirts, making on TV a lot, you know, in some cases they're actually hired talent, you know, kind of posing as fans to fire up the crowd. And I think that's fine. You know, it's part of going to the event is this sort of theater of excitement and energy. But I don't think the teams do as much to engage with their entire fan base. And you got to remember the vast majority of people watch their sport TV. It's a lot more than can make it to the game.
Can caring too much as a fan create just the opposite of what we talked about earlier, happiness, connectedness, anxiety, and depression? Have you found that?
Yeah, I mean, in general, most fans, even a really ardent fan, deals with failure in the long term. You know, the term or the expression time heals all wounds is true even with most sports. And the psychologists have shown that your upside from wins, and especially big wins, it mentally is greater than your potential downside from the losses. And, you know, I think of I'm a Mets fan, right? So I remember 1986, the last time that they won the World Series. I don't really remember 1983 or 1989 or 1993 or all the losing seasons since, but I remember 1986, and I will presumably forever. At the same time, that was a big blow to the Red Sox fans, right? They hated 1986. Mm-hmm. But then they won a bunch of World Series, and that eases a lot of the pain. They remember the wins, and Cubs fans, a perfect example. 108 years you had to wait, but they, you know, that one win, anybody who was a Cubs fan when it happened will remember it for their entire life, more than every other season in the last 108 years. As you mentioned, there are certainly, you know, the majority of Americans, about close to 200 million people, are sports fans, and in that group, there's going to be some who can't deal with it.
Absolutely. Well, a fascinating conversation about fans. I don't think people have really ever thought of this topic in quite this way, and I think you've opened up a whole new prism into looking at sports. The book is called Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. So after this podcast, go check out something. There's got to be something on television right now, sports-related, as we know. Thank you, Larry Olmsted, for being with us today on America Trends. We really do appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.